This is Jeff Bastian, and you're listening to Ignited with Meaning, where we'll be exploring the terrain of a meaningful life, creating a roadmap for that, and generating more happiness along the way. Have you ever wondered what the meaning of life is, or how to make your life more meaningful? We're here to find answers to those questions, and today we'll be talking with Lisa Congdon, who is an incredibly successful artist, illustrator, author, and public speaker, to get her take on meaning, especially from the perspective of women over 40. Lisa interviewed and researched dozens of women in that demographic to write one of her latest books, A Glorious Freedom, Older Women Leading Extraordinary Lives. Lisa's impressive client list includes organizations like the Museum of Modern Art in New York, Harvard University, REI, and Chronicle Books, to name a few. What I love about this interview is that we get to learn a little more about the unique challenges and opportunities that women over 40 have to leading meaningful lives. So even if you don't fit that demographic, you likely are married to someone in that demographic, friends with someone in that demographic, or related to someone in that demographic, like your mom. And this podcast can help you step into their shoes. We also get to learn a lot about Lisa as she began her incredibly successful art career later in life. Lisa didn't start getting into art until her 30s and didn't really ever consider making a profession of it until she was nearly 40. But because she was so successful once she got going, I also wanted to drill down on that. What does it take to achieve the kind of success that she has had doing something that is meaningful to her? Because I think so many people not only want to make their lives meaningful, but they also want to be successful at it, either in terms of the magnitude of impact or the ability to make a living doing it. Within a decade of her professional start as an artist, Lisa had a huge social media following, a really impressive list of clients, and had mastered the business of art as well, to the point where she now has the ability to only accept projects that she can say hell yes to. So without further delay, join me as we hear Lisa's story, learn what it takes to be successful, explore the concept of meaning for older women, and find out how Lisa is living a meaningful life now. Lisa, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here talking to you.
All right. Well, for those of my listeners who have never met you or don't know much about you, it would be great to just have you introduce yourself in your own words. And maybe you can even just start by talking about the point where you got into art.
Yeah, it's an interesting story because unlike many artists, I didn't go to art school. I didn't actually start making art until I was in my 30s. I'm 50 now, so I've been doing it for almost two decades, but it all began when I ended a relationship that I had been in for about almost 10 years, most of my 20s, actually. And I came to realize that the relationship was really unhealthy and that I needed to get out. And so much of my life had been wrapped up in this relationship and in the unhealthy parts of it in some ways. And so for the first time in my life, I was facing questions like, how do I want to spend my time? Like, what matters to me? I hadn't really spent very much time alone until that point. And I began a sort of creative journey. Like, I was taking art classes and experimenting with even cooking and photography. I was sort of on this quest to figure out, you know, what I enjoyed doing. And creativity had sort of always been part of my life. My mom is an artist and my siblings are both really creative. But for me, I was actually the one who was probably the least, or considered the least creative. Like, creativity was probably the least sort of part of my mythology as a family member than anyone. So I ended up going on this journey to sort of figure out what I wanted out of my life and discovered art. And I was first sort of taking classes, but mostly just like set up this little studio on my kitchen table in my little studio apartment in San Francisco. And around that time, the internet was becoming a space for people to share what they were making to, you know, there was a site called Flickr, which many people probably remember, unless you're like young. And it was kind of the first social, social networking site for creatives, because it was this place where you could post pictures, and a lot of people were posting photographs, but then a lot of artists were on there just posting pictures of their work. And I was doing a lot of experimenting with fabric and sewing and painting and drawing and collage. And so I just started posting pictures of what I was making. And as a total 100% hobbyist, like, I never imagined that it would turn into a career. At the time, it was really just this like self-exploration. I fell in love with making. So I did actually discover, you know, the thing that I sought out to discover, which is that there was something that I loved to do outside of work or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of how my journey began. And then over time, I continued to make, continued to share online. And then somewhere in there, there was the moment where it was like, oh, people actually want to buy this stuff. Or people are asking me if it's for sale, or people are saying, hey, I own a store. Would you like to come have a little show, you know, on this blank spot and on the wall in my store or whatever. And so it kind of started really small like that. And then over the last 10 years kind of exploded.
So it sounds to me like there was something missing that you were looking for, and art became that thing. Like, what did art mean to you or bring to you that was previously missing?
I think it was like this sense of purpose and connection in the world that I hadn't previously ever experienced or felt. I think I grew up sort of feeling like my role on the planet was to please other people. I mean, I think this is pretty common, especially for women. And that I grew up in a family where I was sort of like the good girl, right? I did what I was supposed to do. And I felt like I needed to sort of get a job and, you know, get married and, you know, have this sort of traditional life. And found that I was pretty miserable. And I also grew up sort of even into my 20s feeling like I was kind of worthless, or that I wasn't special in any way, or that I didn't have anything. There wasn't anything about me that made me feel good or happy. I mean, I had this interesting job. I worked in education first as a teacher, and then I went to work for an education nonprofit. And I was certainly doing work that felt meaningful to me, but personally, I just didn't necessarily know what I had to offer to the world. And that felt important to me. I've always sort of had a sense of purpose in life that I wanted to give something back. And I was never really sure what that was until I started making art. And actually, even then, that realization didn't happen until years later. But this whole idea that it gave me this way that, you know, it was like sort of tether to meaningful connection with the world, and this way that I could connect with people through images and words. And it made me, you know, it was just sort of this embodiment of like all of the things, like I could visually express what was inside of me. And I ended up over time, because I practiced a lot. I was a terrible artist when I first started. Over time, I got good at doing that in a way that was beautiful and interesting. And it took a lot of hard work, but that I just began to have a sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so art was more than just like this satisfying exercise. It was like something, I think also because I came into it right around the time the internet was becoming a space for people to share their mm-hmm. creative expressions. Mm-hmm. And I sort of glommed onto that because I hadn't gone to art school. I had no art community. So the internet became my art community. And of course, that's changed now. I have like real life relationships with other artists and the creative community. But in the beginning, you know, I was like a person who had zero connection to any other artists. And so the internet became that space for me. And that act of sharing was what got me where I am now. So it's like, I can't separate my art making from the sharing part of it. And I think that's probably a new phenomenon. I know I'm not alone, you know, in, you know, before the internet, people shared their work, but in very sort of like in galleries or through products that they sold or, you know, but it was very, you know, different than it is today. And now there's all this opportunity to become known as an artist and to share what you love to do with other people. And that, and I can't separate them because I started like on the internet, and the internet is why I have an art career. So it's very integral to me. So the sharing part also feels important because it's sort of implicit in that is that I have all these relationships with people who follow me online and, you know, like my work, and that I like that, you know, and when I write books too, it's a similar sort of experience for me that I'm like sharing something that other people can consume in a positive way.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's so many, you know, key things you said there that, you know, the art provided you with a sense of connection to other people and purpose, and that it was like your unique way in order to be able to give. How does art connect you to a person? Is it like, what happens in that? Like you, it sounds like it's an expression of yourself. But that it's also in the way in which it's received, and is it the, can you tell me like what it is more about how that connects you to people?
Yeah, I think that, you know, because so much of my work is shared online, predominantly on Instagram, I will share an image, and most of the time, sometimes I just share an image and I let people sort of interpret it as they will, or, you know, people will often engage in commenting around or send me direct messages around, you know, what it made them think about. But a lot of the time I'll talk about what that particular thing means to me or why I made it, even if the image itself doesn't have words in it, which much of my work does, is like messages. Mm. And so there is this sort of way that what I do sometimes resonates with people, and there's a, you know, I think for a lot of us right now in this time, like the world feels very divided, and there's a lot of I think anxiety among people to varying degrees about who we are as a human race and mm-hmm. what we stand for. And I realized that in the last couple of years that I had to use my platform to talk about the stuff that was important to me, like inclusion and diversity and talking about uncomfortable topics and even things like love and, sort of owning your own experience and like all of these things that have been part of my journey and my ability to sort of live this extraordinary life, right? That I spent a lot of time in my 20s and in my 30s feeling really crappy about myself and my life. And I figured out a way to sort of turn that around. And now part of what I do is engage other people in conversations about, through my work, mm-hmm. about topics that are important to me. Sometimes they're political, but sometimes they're not political at all. They're mm-hmm. they're just like things as humans that we struggle with, like this sense of never being good enough or never doing enough of the right thing, you know, whatever the thing is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my work, I think, particularly resonates for women, but I also have a lot of like men who like my work and engage with my work. So I also use a lot of symbolism in my work. So my work, even my work that's like, doesn't have messages attached to it, you know, there are visual messages or symbols that I use, around that are important to me, and, or that have been significant in my life. And, so there's always, I feel like when you look at art, even abstract art, there's always something to talk about or something that is evoked. And so I like engaging the people who follow my work in conversations about not just my work, but about just stuff that's happening in the world and kind of using my platform and my art practice really for good, you know?
Yeah.
Not just for uh-huh. self-expression.
Right. Right. It seems to me like you're at a point now where those engagements are very authentic, that there's, you know, you're Lisa and there's not a part of you that you're hiding through your work, you know, or that you're only showing a certain part of yourself. Has that been an evolution for you as you've gotten into art and you were trying to figure out what you wanted to say and how you're going to connect with people? Or has it always been the sort of thing where, you know, art's been, you know, you've been fully authentic and transparent about, you know, your beliefs and, you know, thoughts throughout your career?
I think it's definitely been a growth or a sort of evolution. I have, a few things to know about me. I'm gay and I've always been out of the closet, but I definitely, and been speaking more openly in the last few years about why that's important for other people to know, mm-hmm. And why that you know, matters in the context of what's happening in the world. Like, not that my gayness matters, but that, you know, this idea that people who follow me might not have known that about me if they just started following me. And then every now and again, I'll make it clear by posting a picture of my wife and I, or if some sort of anti-LGBTQ issue is coming up, then I'll express an opinion about it. And I think the reason that feels important to me is so that people understand, like, oh, here's this human being whose art I enjoy. And I might not, you know, I might not in the past have even known anyone who identified as gay. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm 16 or 17 and living in the middle of, you know, Tennessee, and I, mm-hmm. you know, and here's this person who's a role model for me, or maybe there's, somebody who's like, oh, here's this human being who I admire. And there's also this thing about her that I'm uncomfortable with, but that I'm going to give a chance because mm-hmm. I like this other part of her, you yeah. know, so that feels important to me. And I also think that, I've also shared, even in the last year, more openly about, like, previous mental health issues I had when I was younger. And I mm-hmm. didn't share that at all for years and years and years. So I'm getting more and more comfortable with this idea of telling the truth. Like, I would have argued 10 years ago that I was being authentic online, but I wasn't sharing as much. And I still have to be sort of, you know, there's this fine line you walk when you are a somewhat public figure who has a large following online. Because on the one hand, you want to, like, be vulnerable or sort of model vulnerability for people because, you know, or models like being real, right? Because mm-hmm. a lot of times we look at people online and we imagine that they have a perfect life, and that maybe as an artist that people might imagine that I get up in the morning and drink my tea and mm-hmm. go work out at the gym. And then I come home and I have this, you know, very romantic experience with creativity. And I like to talk about the fact that creativity is actually this really messy, excruciating process. Mm-hmm. For me in real time and for most artists, because I think that gives permission for other people to not feel like they're feeling if they're experiencing it when they think they should be experiencing it, like, as this romantic, flawless process. So I talk a lot about my struggles with creativity, and I just try to keep it real. And I think I'm getting better and better at that because I'm getting more and more comfortable with, like, oh, if somebody is uncomfortable that I've said something about myself, and even admitting that I'm fallible or that I struggle with creativity does upset some of my followers sometimes. It's clear, mm-hmm. like, they want me to be super confident. Mm-hmm. And the other half of the people are so grateful that I'm, like, admitting uh-huh. that parts of my life are struggle,
yeah.
or that I struggle with things, or that I go through creative slumps, or, you know, depressions, or that I have anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I have to not worry about what the reaction of people is going to be, but trust that by being my true self, that other people will find parts of it that either provide inspiration or comfort to them, or, you know, if it makes them uncomfortable, then, you know, that's fine too. But I also am really careful not to overshare because I have to have privacy, right? Like, that's the balance part.
One of the things that I'm picking up on there is this idea of the struggle and how, you know, living an authentic life or living a life with this, you know, purpose is not necessarily equal an easy and comfortable life. And I feel like I heard you talk a little bit about sort of the early phase of trying to make a business of your artwork, and that was maybe not even the early phase. There was like a decade where you basically said yes to any project that came along. I'm curious to hear a little bit more about that period of like saying yes to all projects and how it helped you in being successful and ways in which it was not as helpful.
Yeah, I actually wrote about this about a year ago, maybe a little more, a little less, but I sort of came out of the closet as having had like this kind of experience of having worked so hard for so many years that kind of got me to where I was in terms of being my work being in demand and having a following online, but also to a place of complete burnout. And I had to make a lot of changes to the way I viewed my work and to the way that I approached my work and to the extent to which I said yes to opportunities. And so in the beginning, I was all about, so you have to remember that by the time, so I started making art when I was in my early 30s. And by the time I was in my late 30s, I started to make a business out of it. So this didn't happen overnight. This was a decade of sort of learning and growing and getting to the place where I could actually draw and paint things that people would want to pay money for. Or, you know, previous to that, it was pretty experimental. And then I sort of started developing a style and settling in on subject matter that, you know, felt important to me. I signed with an illustration agent. So things were happening. I left my job. And my, you know, I both had all of this experience in the working world because I was 39, and that really benefited me. And I also was young enough that I had a lot of energy to like put at this new thing, which, by the way, while I loved my previous career as an educator, like this was what I like was felt passion for. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to become successful at it. And because I was sort of entering this world with somewhat of a disadvantage, I didn't go to art school. I didn't, you know, by the time I started my career, I definitely had more connections in the art world. And I had worked hard at networking and kind of meeting people. I still felt a little bit, you know, like I had to put in more, you know, more effort than the average person. I don't now believe that that's true, but at the time, that's the way I felt. And I also was so grateful when anybody was interested in working with me in any capacity, whether it was, you know, pro bono work, which paid nothing, to something that, you know, was actually going to help me pay my rent. And so I just started saying yes to every opportunity. I was like all about yes, like all about even if an opportunity felt out of my comfort zone, or even if an opportunity was not something I would necessarily render if a client weren't asking me to do it, like there was no, you know, the only filter I had was like, do I have time? But even that filter, I was not paying enough attention to, because I ended up working all of the time, because I hit this tipping point in around 2011, where I started getting regular work. And anybody who does this work knows that the more work you make and the more work you get, the more work you make and put into the world, the more it's like a cycle that just feeds itself, which is awesome. Like, I think it's true for anybody in any sort of client facing career. Like, the more you become known, the more people are telling you, people are telling other people about you. And it was this cycle that sort of fed itself, right? And so the more work I got, the more work I got, and the more work I made and put in my portfolio. And for a while I was fine. And then about 5 years in, I realized that I was, and I think I was sort of in denial, because I would go to bed super exhausted. I would stay up late. You know, my partner is incredibly patient, but I was starting to burn out. The signs were there much sooner, but I hit this point in around 2016 where I woke up one day and literally felt how much physical pain I was in from sitting so much and being at the computer, and how unhappy I was to every day, because I had just continued to have so much opportunity and continued to say yes to all of it. Didn't want to disappoint people. Really hard to say no. So grateful that you want to work with me. How can I say no to this opportunity? I really don't have time, but oh well, I'll do it. And I literally had like a nervous, I don't know, it's kind of like an old fashioned term to say nervous breakdown, but that's the only way I know how to describe it. I just was exhausted, dreading every day, having a major anxiety, and not enjoying making art anymore. Mm. And I was away on a book tour in New York City when I had this realization, and I woke up and I just said, I can't do this anymore. And so many trains had already left the station at that point, and I was committed to some long-term projects. And I figured out that I had 4 or 5 months left, I think, of work that I had to complete. But going forward, I was going to start creating space for myself. I felt like, I describe it in this piece I wrote as being like a, feeling like a sardine enclosed in a can, right? Like there was, I was suffocating. I had no space to even be creative or think about all of the things that I wanted to make and draw and do, because I was so busy making work, client work, and working on books. I mean, a lot of my books are personal projects, so it's not like I was absent my own ideas, but creativity can't happen in that kind of stressful space. It really needs breathing room. And I realized I had zero breathing room left. And so I finished up those projects. I created some space for myself in the beginning of 2017 and just began like approaching taking on work in a very, very different way. And it's not to say since then that I haven't, you know, gone through, you know, a month or two periods at a time where I'm feeling a little overwhelmed. But for the most part, I've been really judicious about, you know, and sometimes passing up stuff that it's kind of mind blowing, the stuff that I have to say no to, because it, you know, because it's like a really cool project or whatever. But I've gotten really good at saying no. I stopped traveling for a while, which was also burning me out. 2016, I was on 28 airplanes and I just was done. And so I started meditating. I started, you know, focusing on self-care, and I have come a long way, and I am feeling like so much better about my approach to my work. But it took getting to the place where I was saying yes to everything and burned out to learn this lesson and make a shift. And I think that happens for a lot of people. People know that they are doing too much, but it's not until they literally break.
Yeah.
And they know they need to make a change.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, some of us push it a little too far.
Yeah. So one of the things that is interesting is that, you know, from 2011 to 2016, you were saying yes to everything,
pretty
which
much
is a really long time. That's like 5 years of sustained hard work. And one of the things I'm curious about is, you know, for people who are looking to kind of accelerate and move into a new space, you know, that's their passion and they're trying to make a career of it. Like, seems like working hard is a well-worn path, or like a proven path to that success. And so there's some element of it that I would have to imagine, I don't know, is there a smarter way? Like, is it important to go through a period of sustained hard work if you're looking to propel yourself into something new?
You know, I struggle so much with that question because I don't advocate that anybody do what I did. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it is, I think, in many ways, the reason that I became so well known and successful. So I struggle with that question because, you know, sometimes I don't do coaching, but sometimes I do a lot of public speaking or I teach workshops. And so my students will ask me some version of that question. Mm-hmm. And I am definitely an advocate for discipline and hard work and practice and showing up every day and doing the work. Like, there's no way around that. Mm-hmm. If you want to build an audience for your work and, develop your voice as a writer or an artist. Like, there's no way to do it by sitting back. Like, you have to dive in, and you have to do it a lot, and you have to do it over and over and over, even when it becomes kind of boring. And saying yes to professional opportunities as an artist, whether you're a fine artist or an illustrator, is really an important part of launching your career. So the question becomes, like, for each person, what is their threshold? I think the important thing is to pay attention to how your body feels and how you feel. And if you're feeling yourself being unhappy, what is the point? And that's exactly what I came to. And I just think that, you know, for some people, the workload I have now, which is way less than I was doing during those 5 years, mm-hmm. is more than some people can wrap their head around. I have a very high threshold for work. I'm extremely organized. Like, I teach a workflow time management class on Creative Life because I'm really good at that. And then part of that is because I worked for years and years in the nonprofit world where I was managing projects and working with people in various capacities. And I learned those skills, and it's really helped me in my art career. But everyone's threshold is different. And figuring out what your threshold is for hard work, because you can't avoid the hard work, but everyone's threshold for hard work and saying yes and showing up is different. And you have to constantly, I think, be in tune with your own sense of happiness and satisfaction and make adjustments based on that. And you can't compare yourself to other people and what other people do. And I think that's the danger of social media, is that people see people like me and they say, oh my God, you do so much. You teach and you do illustration and you write books and you run this successful Etsy shop and you are now opening a retail shop and a workshop space and you do public speaking and, you know, how do you do all these things? Or maybe I should be doing all those things. And so it was important for me to sort of come out of the closet as like having burned out, for people to understand that like this doesn't come that easily. Also, my threshold is just higher. And as I get older, it's getting lower and lower too. So I find every year I'm a little less motivated to like do everything and do it all, and that I'm sort of focusing on a handful of things that I like to do the best and the most. And now I'm also like, I have so many income streams that worrying about whether something is going to pay the bills is less of an issue. So I have more freedom to kind of choose the things that feed me more than the things that, by feed me, I mean like spiritually and like emotionally and mentally and intellectually, not literally feed me, but, and worry less about what's, you know, paying the rent or like paying my bills, which was what I was dealing with in the beginning. And also part of why I said yes to everything too. So it's hard. That's such a hard question.
But what I'm hearing you say, though, and, you know, feel free to tweak it, is that the hard work is critical to success, and that people should be, you know, prepared that if they want to move forward, they have to do that. And then the art of that is to understand what your threshold is and to kind of play around with approaching that, the edge of that threshold, to see if you can sustain your happiness, but also that there's a little bit, kind of going back to our other theme of like some suffering, that if you are prepared to kind of like suffer through some of the tedium, some of the hard work, some of those other things, that's ultimately going to be rewarding, because you're going to be able to see what you know, realize what your aim is. So if you were to kind of do those 5 years over again, like in a way that is smarter, you know, like I think working hard and, you know, being ready to do that makes a lot of sense with all the caveats that you just suggested. But then also, you know, is there a way for that you think you would have been able to achieve some of the same success without the burnout?
100%. So I've been reflecting on this a lot. And one of the things that I realized when that period came to a head is that in every situation where I took on one or two or three more projects, my intuition was telling me this is not a good idea, but I did it anyway. And so I take a moment And I really think, okay, is this opportunity something that I'm excited about? Do I feel overwhelmed by it? Do I truly believe I have time in my schedule and not at 9 o'clock at night, but in my regular daily schedule? Does the pace of this project feel, you know, doable given the amount of time I have? Am I going to feel, you know, and I listen to all of that and I trust my intuition. And if my intuition has like bad feelings, then I say no. And if I have good feelings, then I say yes. Now, your intuition isn't always going to be exactly right. So sometimes I've said yes to something that's taken a little bit longer, but for the most part, it's working really well. And so I'm just really listening. Instead of just saying yes immediately, I always think about things for like at least 24 hours. And I talk it through with my partner and even with my friends. Do you think I should do this? I ask a lot of questions of the client. What's your timeline? What's your process? You know, I don't assume anything. And so this idea of just not saying yes willy-nilly, but really just listening to my intuition, that is something I could have. If I had done that, I would have been in far less trouble. And that's something you learn over time, because in the beginning of any career, creative endeavor, your intuition can't tell you much because everything is coming at you is so new. Everything is a new experience. But after a few years, you know what kind of work you like to do. You know how long it takes you to get things done. You have a pretty good sense of whether or not a job, as it's described to you, or a gig or an opportunity, you know, is going to be a good thing, or if it makes you really nervous. And I think the trick is also figuring out, am I uncomfortable because this is out of my comfort zone in a good way? Or am I uncomfortable because this is out of my comfort zone because it really is just something that is like going to overwhelm me because of the time constraints or how much I'm going to have to work to get it done.
Right. Well, one of the things that you said yes to was writing this book called A Glorious Freedom. And it featured, you know, women over 40 who are living extraordinary lives. Can you tell me how the idea for this book came about and why you decided to write it?
Yeah. So there's a little story behind it. In 2000, I think it was around 2012 or 13, I was the keynote speaker at a big blogging conference, and I gave a talk about my path and everything, and a woman who I had known online who was also blogging, I don't keep a blog anymore, but at the time I was also a blogger, like also kept a blog, and she's a photographer also, and she invited me into her hotel room to take my portrait. She was taking a series of portraits of women over 40, and she took my portrait with this Hasselblad like film camera, and the light in her hotel room was really beautiful. And anyway, she sends me the image, and it really kind of like exposed all. I don't have very many wrinkles. I look young for my age, let's be clear. But like, I was mortified by this photo. It was a beautiful portrait, but it made me really uncomfortable. So I sat with it for a few days, and then I decided that I had always sort of embraced other aspects of getting older, like just sort of owning your experience and the idea. And like, I'd never been one to be like, hide my age or anything. I'm quite proud of the fact that I like did all these things as an, you know, older person, and that I'm self-taught and all of those things. But like, this picture of myself where my age was showing, which I'm sure was also a side effect of all of the work I was doing in the late nights, really bothered me. And so I thought, oh, I can't just embrace some of the aspects of getting older. I have to embrace all of them, including how my body is changing, how I'm changing physically. And so I ended up writing this blog post about that experience. And in my sort of small world of readership, went viral, the post, because it was, you know, affirming that I, you know, was going to choose to like accept myself and all the things that aging brings, as opposed to reject it or hide it. And again, in what we were talking about earlier, this idea sort of being authentic, it was definitely in that vein. Uh-huh. And so I have an editor at Chronicle Books who I've worked with for years, and she, of course, reads every blog post that I formerly wrote when I kept a blog. And she emailed me and was like, I think this is a topic for a book. And I said, but how? What do you mean? And she said, I don't know, but I just think you ought to think about it, because it's obviously a topic that's resonating with other women. And I don't think there's a whole lot out there about older women. And so I started thinking about, okay, what is this that's like touching people? And I think a lot of it, and what I realized was that a lot of it is that, you know, especially for women, this idea of getting older is seen as a sort of negative thing. You know, maybe you become more sort of grandmotherly or wise or whatever, but like, we sort of lose power as we get older. I had a journalist once asked me for an interview because she was writing an article about how women who were turning 30 were feeling like if they hadn't accomplished all of the big things in their life that they wanted to accomplish by the time they were 30, that they had somehow failed. And she wanted my perspective. And that is a reality. Let alone it's 30. That's wow. Even 40 yeah. or 50, right? And I thought there's so many examples of women who either didn't reach the apex of their career until much later in life, or who didn't start something until later in life, some, you know, sort of like me, and women who really embraced getting older and who, for whom it was like a really positive experience. And I thought, it's a positive experience for me. I see part of why I'm successful in my career as an artist is because I'm older, because I know so much about how to communicate with people and how to organize my time, and like, there's so much wisdom and power that we bring, that age brings, whatever our experience is. And so I started researching, and I wrote a book proposal, and ended up writing a book that is really sort of, you know, I wrote the introduction and a lot of the profiles in the book, but it's a collection of different things. So there's essays by women over 40 about their experience of getting older. There are interviews with women who have done some interesting things, you know, or started new parts of their life when they were older, like a woman who started medical school when she was 50. Mm-hmm. And there are also profiles of women from history, and some living women who started the thing that they're known for now when they were older. And a lot of people don't know that about these women. And my goal was really to inspire women out there to embrace getting older and to understand that it actually is sort of like, it can be a really powerful experience. And, and then I illustrated the essays and profiles in the book as well. So it was kind of a, you know, most of it is words, but there are definitely some pieces of my art in there too.
Do you have any other sort of favorite stories that, you researched and talked to so many different women? Are there stories or interviews that kind of keep coming back to you as inspiration?
All of the stories in the book are inspiring. And I think that the thing that inspired me the most was this like idea that most of the women just were like, screw it, you know, I'm going to do this thing. And every single day they had to get up and fight like a lifetime of being told that they couldn't or believing that they couldn't. And they still did it anyway. And some of them did some really extraordinary things, but not without struggle, right?
Yeah.
You know, we still live in a sort of misogynistic society that, that, you know, makes us believe that, you know, aging, especially for women, is an entirely negative experience. And yet I was meeting all of these women who were, you know, doing everything in their power in their daily life to sort of dismantle those beliefs. And, one of the most inspiring women in the book is Betty Reed Soskin. She's actually the very last person in the book. And she's also one of the oldest people in the book, and she's in her 90s, and she is the oldest living park ranger. And Betty's amazing, not only because she's like this super healthy, vibrant 90 3 or 4 year old. I actually interviewed her on my book tour, which was a total pleasure. And she has like a Presidential Medal of Honor, and she works in this park in Richmond, California, where she gives talks. Part of what's inspiring about her is that she's talking about the wartime experience for, she's African-American. And so she's talking about the wartime experience and trying to educate people about what, you know, what it was like being a Black person back in the 20s, 30s, 40s. You know, she has this rich life experience, right? And she gets to talk about that and her life and how she ended up. She's actually only been working as a park ranger since she was in her 80s.
Wow. You know,
yeah. And sort of how she got into that work. So her work is like, is meaningful, not only because she's this older person, but that she's talking about the experience of her own life and her life, you know, her experience as a Black person in America and over, you know, a period of time that, you know, where things were very different. You know, I mean, lots hasn't changed, but
yeah,
a lot of things have changed. And I think those stories are really important. So she's really incredible on a number of levels. And she's also just a badass. Like, she gets out of bed and goes to this job, you know, in a park ranger uniform every day. And, you know, is like in her mid 90s. And that alone is inspiring, that she's like literally gets up every day to do good work in the world. Like, she cannot imagine not doing that. Like, why would the fact that I'm older and more tired stop me from going and telling stories to people and giving back to the world, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, we all, in fact, I am in a position of privilege here. Like, I have all of this life experience to share. I shouldn't be sitting at home in a rocking chair. Like, I should be out working. And I think that's, we're going to see more and more of that now because people are living longer because of healthcare and people are working longer. And, you know, I think we're going to see more and more people work in the workforce or doing their thing. And I also think just because of like, the feminist movement, like, I think we're going to see more and more women in particular, like, working until they're older and like giving back until they're older. And there are so many examples. Like, after I wrote the book, I just was inundated with emails from people like about women who could have been featured in my book.
Yeah.
I was like, oh darn it. I wish I had known about this person. Cause there's just so many examples of older women who are doing really spectacular things out in the world at an older age and who didn't start doing those things until they were even in their 60s or 70s. They just needed a new thing to do. And then they ended up doing some really transformative things. So I'm hoping that the book is inspiring women to sort of like not settle into getting older as a, you know, as a way of just, you know, a lot of women, I think, retire and they become sad and depressed or like don't feel a sense of purpose. I think that the opposite is also true for a lot of women. But this idea that it's like, as we get older, whether we're in our 40s or at retirement age or even in our 70s or 80s, that it's never too late to try the thing that you've always wanted to try to do, even if it's just to say you did it. You know, not necessarily to like change the world. And I think sometimes in some ways, like, that message is more important, because if you want to change the world, that's great. And if you want to be inspired by some of the women in the book who have made some, you know, big impact on the world, that's also great. But there are a few women in the book who are just like regular people who just did kind of things that aren't ever going to make them famous, but are really pretty incredible in their own right, because they just did it. Like the woman who went to medical school at an older age, or like the woman who in the book, who's a marathon walker, and she started in her 60s after her husband died because she was grieving and she needed something to do. So she started walking and then became like a long distance marathon walker. And she's never going to be famous for that, but like, it's this extraordinary thing that she did, that made her, filled her life up again and made her happy after this really devastating thing happened in her life. And that's like, to me, those, in some ways, those are the most inspiring things, because they're the most common or the most accessible for people.
Yeah. And one of the themes I actually picked up on, and I think I first read it in her story, was this idea that women over 40 feel invisible. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that theme? Like, how many of the women that you talked to had that sense of, like, as soon as they turn 40, people just, what is that experience like? And what does that mean for them?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, the title of the book, A Glorious Freedom, is actually a turn of phrase from the essay by Caroline Paul that you just referred to. When she turned 50, she went out and learned to surf. And most of her essay is about that. But towards the end of the essay, she talks about sort of walking into this shack or whatever near the beach where she's surfing and maybe buying a coffee right at a cafe in this shack cafe. And that, you know, so much of our identity as women is how men, you know, perceive us or how they react to us and how seen we feel, especially by men. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that's often, you know, part of how we perceive our value in the world is through that lens, right? And then the older you get, the less attractive you become, right, as a woman. Mm-hmm. And that you become, even if you were a really insanely physically attractive person, that you become less attractive and then you therefore become invisible. Like young men who used to, you know, flirt with you at the cash register while you're buying your coffee, you're now invisible to them to the point where they barely make eye contact with you. And she talks about that as being a glorious freedom, mm-hmm. that really this being invisible while sort of annoying and disheartening to a lot of women is actually a freedom, because when so much of your identity is bound up in how you look, when it no longer is, you're actually free. Right.
Yeah.
And that to me was such a beautiful thing. We asked her permission to call the book A Glorious Freedom, because really that's what getting older is. You become free because all of these things that constrained you or that you worried about when you were younger, you no longer worry about. And part of being invisible is a sort of freedom in that way. But it is a really common thing that if you were to sort of Google, you know, some search words about, you know, invisibility in older women, you'll find a lot of people are writing about it, because it is this thing that I think, especially now, women are talking more about. You know, it's always been the case, but now we're talking about it. And I think what Caroline was trying to do in her essay was to sort of embrace it as a, you know, own it, embrace it as a positive thing. It's going to happen no matter what. So, and then in the act of that, you know, kind of not worrying so much about whether you're visible or invisible, but just doing the thing that you want to do or making the impact in the world you want to make without worrying about, you know, your appearance is, you know, and that's a level of power that, that's different than the power we hold in being attractive or not attractive. And so much of our identity as women is bound up in that, in a way that it's not for men.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, it's wonderful. I'm really glad that you wrote the book and have, you know, I imagine that kind of going back to that theme of meaningful, it's that creative process, sharing it and putting it out in the world, and the connection that you feel with all the people you spoke to in the book and all the readers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I still to this day get emails my book group just read A Glorious Freedom and we loved it. Or, you know, I do think it's a book that I hope inspires people to just sort of think about their life differently, or give them some inspiration and hope. And I'm certainly getting a lot of feedback that it's doing that for people. So that makes me happy.
Great. I think that's what, you know, a lot of us want, is to be able to give in a way that contributes to the world. And your contribution here is helping inspire, you know, women to, especially women over 40, to be able to take those steps and try something new.
Yeah. And to shine and be seen and put yourself out there. Cause I think, you know, we often, we get older and we think we need to hide, we need to own our, you know, this idea of being invisible, that we literally need to become invisible. But I think it's the best possible time to just pursue your wildest dreams and be, you know, do crazy things. And I mean that in the best way.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I think this idea of overnight success is dangerous because I think it also causes people to sort of give up because they think if I don't get this thing immediately, then I've somehow failed. And when in fact, it's the sort of like plodding through everyday life and showing up and doing the work when nobody's paying attention, that is the most important work to do. It's not the sort of the book getting published or getting on the New York Times bestseller list or whatever. It's the work that goes into making those kinds of things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because those kinds of those like stellar moments don't happen for most people, but that doesn't make their careers any less worthy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So one of the other things that you've said yes to recently, as I understand, is that you're helping to form a nonprofit for LGBTQ artists right here in Portland. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
It's actually for LGBTQ artists and artists of color. Uh-huh. And I co-founded what is now becoming a nonprofit with my friend Eugenie Fontana. She is African American. We met about a week after the election in 2016. I was speaking at a local AIGA here in Portland. And AIGA is like a graphic designers organization. And I was in conversation with a local designer, and we hadn't planned to talk about how my work might change as a result of the election, which I wasn't happy about. But because it had just happened, there was no avoiding it. And there was a sort of like darkness in the room that, you know, everyone was sort of overwhelmed with what had just happened in American politics. And so we ended up just talking about how my work might change or how I might use my platform differently in the wake of the election. And Eugenie was in the audience, and I also had talked about sort of working in social justice in the context of my job in education. I worked for a nonprofit that had a social justice mission in the Bay Area. And she came up to me afterwards and was like, "Hey, do you want to have coffee sometime?" And so we ended up going out and had a 4-hour coffee / lunch. And she said, "You know, I feel like one of the things," she's an artist and designer, and she said, "I feel like one of the things that is so heavy and present in Portland is that the visibility for artists of color and LGBTQ artists is not as rich and as it could be." Mm-hmm. That so there's so many, such a great creative community, but most of the people who show up at things or are asked to speak on panels or whatever are sort of white men in particular. Mm-hmm. And I want to do something to elevate the profile of artists of color and LGBTQ artists in this city. And I also want to do something to create pathways for emerging artists and younger artists to grow into positions of power and influence in the Portland art and design community. Do you have any interest in that as a cause? And I said, absolutely. So we've been working for the last couple of years to organize around that topic. And so we have a membership. We also started our LGBTQ folks and artists of color who are creatives of color, LGBTQ creatives who are both experienced and sort of new in the world and are, you know, and we're talking to them about what issues they're facing in their workplace and in their ability to sort of be, you know, have a career and how we can support them. We also are starting a partnership with PNCA, which is Pacific Northwest College of Art, where we're going to be starting programming around issues specific to, you know, under underrepresented groups in the art world. Mm-hmm. And also start a mentorship program next year where younger LGBTQ, specifically trans and artists of color, can get mentorship around, you know, making connections, figuring out sort of like how to get their work into the world and have successful careers. So our goal is really to level the playing field here in Portland for now. We'll see if it turns into anything beyond that. But we're called We Are Here. And we're sort of at this forming stages right now. So we don't even really have a full website or anything like that. But it is, you know, equity and inclusion are really important, I don't know, topics for me or sort of causes. And so I spend a good deal of my time recently working on this project with Eugenie. And then we've also brought onto our leadership team an artist, a local artist who's also the dean of equity and inclusion at PNCA. And his name is Victor Maldonado. So the three of us are currently running the organization. And recently we also did an event in Design Week where we brought in leaders from the Portland art and design community to get training on how to create a workplace where, you know, LGBTQ and people of color can come and work that where they feel like they want to be. And where there's like a lot of times, if diversity is a problem and people aren't hiring a diverse staff, they'll say, well, either one of two things, there are no Black people in Portland. How can we hire them? You know, which is not true. Right. Or, you know, there's some excuse, or we've hired them, but they don't stay. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because the culture of most workplaces is modeled on, you know, by, you know, white men. And, and so rethinking like how we set up our workspaces so that they're inclusive and that everyone's perspective is valued. And we think we're doing that, but we're obviously not doing a good enough job. So how can we change workplace culture for both for hiring and retention of a diverse staff? So we've also been doing some work in that area because we realized if we're mentoring folks to go into that system, but we're not preparing the system,
right?
Or the system isn't changing, then we're going to keep having issues. You know, people aren't going to stay.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that seems like really wonderful work. I know that at my workplace, we've done a diversity and inclusion audit, and all of those, you know, challenges, you know, even for a progressive company that is out there doing good work in the world, there still are, you know, there's a lot of learning to be done there.
Yes, like the most well-intentioned people in some ways have the most to learn because we already are trying so hard to do it right, but we don't even realize what we might be doing wrong. And just listening to people of color and LGBTQ folks around like what they need or what we might perceive as a microaggression that other people don't even realize that they're sort of, you know, putting out there in the workplace and things like that. So, yeah, it's unending work too. It takes a really long time and a lot of commitment on everybody's part. So that sometimes feels overwhelming, but also work that I feel like needs to be done.
So what is the name of this nonprofit and do you have active, it sounds like you have some active projects, but it's pretty formative.
We're called We Are Here. Mm-hmm. And we do have a website that has basic information.
Yeah.
It's not fully fleshed out or designed yet.
Yeah.
And I can get you the URL so you can put it on your website.
That's great.
Yeah. So I think we're going to, in the next year, get to the place where we've got definitely much more of a presence online.
Uh-huh. Well, to wrap things up, Lisa, do you have any, you know, sort of final advice or words of wisdom for either, you know, women over 40 or LGBTQ and African-American or people of color artists that you would, you know, leave with them who are wanting to lead more extraordinary lives?
I think for me, the thing that gets me out of bed every morning is this understanding that my voice matters. I think most of us, especially people who are part of you know, marginalized subgroups, specifically trans folks, or, you know, and people of color, specifically Black people, you know, have been told and treated for so long like their voice doesn't matter. And in fact, your voice matters even more. Mm-hmm. And telling your story or using your creative process to amplify your story is so incredibly important. Like, the world will not change. And I know that's a huge challenge, because there is so much, you know, oppression and racism in the world. But the extent to which we can sort of use our voices to create change and do good in the world is the extent to which, you know, the world will change, right? Like, that we can't change the paradigm of power in this country in particular, unless people are speaking out and speaking their truth, even when other people don't want to hear it or mm-hmm. don't like how they say it, you know? Yeah. And so I would just encourage everyone, no matter who you are, where you come from, or what your background is, to tell your story and to own your story. And also to listen to other people's stories and consider what other people have to say with an open mind. So,
yeah. Well, Lisa, it has been a real pleasure to speak with you today. I am very inspired by your life. I've really enjoyed, you know, learning about you over the last couple of weeks, and enjoyed this conversation tremendously.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me. This was really fun.
All right.
I hope you've enjoyed this interview with Lisa Congdon. Since taping the show, I've been paying more attention to how, like Lisa, I find meaning in connecting with others over my work in this podcast. If you've been listening and enjoying this show but haven't reached out, please go to my website at ignitingwithmeaning.com and send in a comment. Let's connect. To find out more about Lisa, check her out at lisacongdon.com or look for the link to her website, and we are here in the show notes. In the next show, we'll be switching gears quite a bit along gender lines and talking with Ivan Skellum. Ivan developed a roadmap for men, looking to guide them from what he calls the city of eternal slumber to the land of the risen king. If that sounds a little bit like a cross between The Matrix and The Lord of the Rings to you too, Ivan has found a really beautiful way to incorporate themes and character archetypes we often see in movies and apply them to the journey of men's lives in a really powerful and compelling way. So if that sounds intriguing to you, please tune into the next episode. Thanks again for listening to Ignited with Meaning, where we're exploring the terrain of a meaningful life, creating a roadmap for that, and generating more happiness along the way. I hope you're walking away with some ideas and inspiration for living a meaningful life yourself and starting to take the first steps towards that. If you did, please rate this podcast with 5 stars and write a review. That's one of the best ways to increase visibility for the show. Until next time, be persistent, keep looking, and together we'll build the meaningful lives we want.